joy to welcome you to Academy Christian Church. For those of you joining us online, it's exciting to be able to share the experience of worship with those who are in the room. We unite with those who are at our Westside campus as we turn to the Word of God and let Him speak to us today. For all of us in this room, a Bible in your hand would be a great place to start. We've made Bibles available to you in the seats there. Go on your phone, get on. We're in Genesis chapter 37. We're actually going to be walking through a long passage together that might be helpful to you. There's also an insert in the bulletin that you could use for this purpose as well. Here's a notice that kind of gets me going. Detour. Are you kidding me? 50 questions pop up in my head in a flash. Don't you understand that I'm on a schedule? Where's the dumb thing taking me? I wonder if I could find the phone number of the construction crew leader, because I'd like to give him a piece of my mind. And right now you're saying, careful, Dave, you don't have any pieces to spare in this process here. But I'm thinking, the complaint I would like to register. I'm not a fan of detours. I want my travel to be storm-free, slow driver free, no semis on the road, no mounties on the side of the road, no accidents, obstacles, no detours. That's how I roll. Well, not actually. Almost every trip has something. Delay, diversion, deferral, deviation, disturbance, interruption, intrusion, imposition, interference. Almost every trip has something. And yet I still seem to start almost every adventure with the expectation that nothing's going to get in my way. Maybe there's a problem with my reality. This sermon series is about detours. We will spend 6 weeks looking at detours. Life is full of them. Some detours are small and quickly handled, easily forgotten. Other detours take you far away from where you were going. Some detours are so significant that the original destination that you had in mind can't even be reached from here unless you make a thoroughly alternative plan. That's the kind of plan you never wanted to make, right? You can tell that we're not talking about automotive or airline travel here. We're talking about life detours. When the plan was here, but this interruption of life experience took me over here. The distance from here to here is nothing but pain. As we initiate this series, we need to define one dominating teaching point. I hope that you get this through every sermon that we experience in the course of this next 6 weeks. Here's the central point. God is in the detours. He has a sovereign destiny larger than any single interruption. And what that means is that if you are in a chapter of your life right now that you don't care for, there's another chapter that is yet to be written. And we should look and consider what God might be doing in that, where we would ask an important question. Would you allow God to write a new chapter, a chapter you never experienced? Would you allow Him to use you as the center, the main character in a plot, and submit to His will for a new pathway? His vision is larger than yours. His purpose is deeper than yours. He sees what you don't see. He knows what you don't know. But would you allow Him to write that next chapter? Isaiah the prophet declares the word of the Lord in Isaiah 55 when God says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens is higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, my thoughts higher than your thoughts." I got to tell you, that verse presents a great conflict in my mind. See, I prefer my way. That's what I'm used to. That's what I like to pursue, which is why I probably get so agitated when I encounter detours. At the outset, I'd have to admit that God's vision for my life and my vision for my life don't always start at the same place. Let me explain. It is clear that, you see, my vision for life is that I be happy and comfortable. Almost all of my effort goes in that direction. I want things to make me happy. I want to be comfortable in the process. And so all of my energy presses toward those ends. But God's vision for my life is that I be faithful and obedient and purposeful with His mission in mind. And those two trails are very different. So that means when you have been detoured by life, you should know that God has much more in mind for what He's attempting to lead you to. Over the course of these next 6 weeks, we're about to stumble through a series of detours. And we're going to do it by walking through the life of an Old Testament personality. His name is Joseph. You might be very familiar with who he is. On the other hand, this story might be brand new to you. He is a striking man, or should I say a boy, who grows into a man, who becomes a man of faith through a series of catastrophic life detours. We're going to rehearse his life for a 22-year span of time, from the moment he was 17 years old until he's 39 years of age, we'll walk through the crises he encountered. That's a long stretch of time, lots of detours. We begin his story in a place of substantial dysfunction. Did you know that Joseph came from a highly dysfunctional family? You don't find that word in the Old Testament, but if we were going to look at it through all of our psychoanalysis today, we would say he came from a highly dysfunctional family. This man who's noticed with tremendous character, this man who is observed for his deep integrity, he came from a dysfunctional family. But that man is very important. He merits more printed page in the book of Genesis than Adam, the first man of all mankind, than Noah, who brought humanity through the account of the flood, than Abraham, who is the father of all the nations of God's revelation. Joseph gets more print than them all. We intend to use this man as our teacher for the next several weeks. He's one of those who rose out of dysfunction to manifest a rock-solid faith. And I want to know how he did that. So let's begin where his story begins. We're in Genesis chapter 37. We've got a long section to walk through. It's all narrative. We're just telling a story. Let's begin in verse 2. This is the account of Jacob's family. Let's get some context here. There's father Abraham, his son Isaac, and then his son Jacob. This is a grandson to Abraham. Are you with me? Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah, sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought to their father a bad report about them. Now, Israel, who's Israel? Well, Israel and Jacob are the same man. Israel, that name of the nation, is fathered by this man, Jacob. Israel, Jacob, loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age. And he made this ornate robe, that's an interesting word in the Hebrew. It could mean, we often translate it as being colorful. It might be that. It really more has to do with the richness of fabric and the embroidery, the stitchery, the fine work there. It's an extraordinary garment. He made it for him. Verse 4. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, what? They hated him. Could not speak a kind word for him. Do you feel the tension of the home? Then Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. Watch the swelling of hatred develop in this text. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain, long stalks of grain, out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose, stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it. Oh, his brother said to him, do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us? Oh, and they hated him. There's the phrase again. They hated him all the more because of his dream and what he said. Verse 9, then he had another dream. He told it to his brothers. Listen, he said, I had another dream. And this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. When he told his father, as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream you've had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you? His brothers were jealous of him. Here's an interesting phrase, but his father kept the matter in his mind. Do you recognize that kind of phrase? Reminds me of the phrase that Mary, the mother of Jesus, when she had taken Jesus to the temple at his early birth, there were some prophetic words of announcement given about this boy, and it troubled her heart, but she pondered them in her heart, it says. It's when you see some element of truth that you really can't put your finger on, but you don't know what to do with it, so you just leave it in your mind. The text says that the father kept this matter in mind. Verse 12. Now his brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near a region called Shechem. And Israel, that's Jacob, he said to Joseph, as you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I'm going to send you to them. Very well, Joseph replied. On to verse 17, the second portion. So Joseph went after his brothers. He found them near Dothan. But they saw him in the distance. Understand what's going on here. But before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. They saw this strange figure coming in the distance. But they recognized something, something. Oh, it was the robe. The robe. They plotted to kill him. Here comes that dreamer, verse 19. They said to each other, come now, let us kill him, throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal has devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. On to verse 23. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe. First chance they get to get rid of that image of our father's love. They strip that robe off of him. The first thing they do. That ornate robe that he was wearing, they took him and threw him into a cistern. That's just a big water cavity. The cistern was empty because there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat their meal. When they looked up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites. That's an ethnic group from the line of Ishmael. Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded. I've not listed all the words that they were loaded with for our sake of time today. But they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him on to Egypt. About a 500-mile journey, by the way. Then they got Joseph's robe. They had to come up with a plan. Now Joseph's gone. We got to organize the story. They slaughtered a goat, dipped the robe in blood. They took the ornate robe back to their father and said, we found this. Examine it to see whether it's your son's robe. And that's Jacob, he recognized it and said, it is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his clothes. He put on sackcloth, mourned for his son many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, saying, no, I will continue to mourn until I join my son in the grave. Pause right there on that phrase, because if there's anyone in this room who has lost a child, you know the anguish of those words. My grieving will remain until I join my child in the grave. So his father wept for him. A summary statement of this chapter, verse 36. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to a fellow by the name of Potiphar. We'll get to his story next week. One of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. Enormous drama in that story. That narrative reflects extraordinary pain. All of that happened when Joseph was 17. What a sad story. If you were to use him as a case study, you would have to assume that there is a deeper root to the problems that you have observed in the glance of a chapter, and you'd be absolutely right about that. Things didn't just start getting messed up for Joseph when he was 17. Joseph had a father by the name of Jacob. The scripture describes there's another name given to him by virtue of a handle or a moniker. He's called the supplanter. You know what that word means? It means that you grab a heel and you hang on and you do it through treachery. Someone who trips someone up by treacherous deeds. You might call him a chiseler, one who would use a chisel as a tool to always shape things according to his longing. That's the word. Now you got to understand that later Jacob's name was changed to Israel, but God did eventually use Israel mightily, but that was after he got his life straightened out. It's a great story about a man who gets himself fixed up and changes things, makes for a wonderful testimony on Wednesday night prayer meeting at church. But don't forget that by the time Dad got himself reorganized, his kids were pretty well messed up. Would you like to see a dysfunctional family? This family includes one husband, two wives, Leah and Rachel, two concubines, Bilhah and Zilpah, in other words, two women who had children by this man, the chiseler. That means there were four mothers, 11 sons, one daughter, all living under the same roof. And you thought you had some challenge at your house this week. Instead of marital bliss, there was jealousy and strife and anger and lust and deceit and competition, secrecy, extremes of manipulation. You know, I believe that the event that defines the character of this man, Jacob, is described in chapter 34 of Genesis, when his daughter got raped. His response is one where he seems more concerned about how that event is going to affect his reputation than all the things that his daughter in trauma was facing. That's the kind of man Jacob, the chiseler, was at one time. All he could think about is how this affects me. Now, Jacob the chiseler, he got himself straightened out, but that was after the kids had pretty well been messed up. When you realize all of that, chapter 37, why, it's not much of a surprise at all. As a matter of fact, it's exactly what you would expect from the family of a chiseler. Now, in this chapter, there is absolutely no healing. Not one good thing happens in chapter 37. Things go from bad to worse. We read here of no healing. It comes later. It's an amazing story of reconciliation and restoration and purpose. But for today, I just want to remind you of the seeds of dysfunction, because there are some warning signs in this part of the text. All we read in chapter 37 is about what causes dysfunction in this family, what has been planted to bring such brokenness. Pay attention to the warnings. Warning number one, it's the seeds of commonness. No family is exempt from adversity. You know, if things are going great for your family right now, enjoy that. But hang on, because the winds of change will blow. That's just the way life is. And if things are terrible for you right now, just hang on. Someday soon, the wind will blow in a different direction. That's just the way life is. If your family is struggling, goodness sakes, welcome to the club. But remember, this family, the family I just read about, is the very family that God singled out in order to evidence his own character and fulfill his redemptive plan on the earth. Goodness sakes, if God can work through that bunch, he can work through what you've got. It's another of the amazing features of the plan of God. His handiwork in the heavens and all the created beauty is actually child's play to the orchestration of life among humankind and the redemptive wonder of Jesus Christ. No family is exempt from adversity, not even the family that God uses to establish his own revelation. Somebody in that generation that belongs to you, someone in your home is going to take a wild turn. And they will engage self-destructive behaviors, and with every one of those behaviors, they will begin a long process of hurting everyone and everything they touch. It's so messy. And yet, if there is a glimmer of hope in this sermon today, as we peek through the windows of that messed up home, it is this, that though you may be witnessing the most devastating set of experiences right now, do not count God out. There is another chapter to be written. You're expecting, and he is waiting, and he begins to take that ugly mess and draw people toward a moment of reconciliation. He is longing for people to hear his voice, but you know, if you have been through it, this time, this season, you're in for quite a ride. Don't give up. No family is exempt from adversity. There's a second warning here in chapter 37. Note the seeds of idleness. No enemy is more subtle than passivity. You know what I think this father's greatest sin was? I don't believe it was his adultery, although that sin cost him greatly and brought much pain. This man's greatest sin was not about that Jacob had spent the last several decades in an angry feud with his brother Esau. We didn't read about that section, but it was hostile and violent. That sin caused much sorrow, but that was not this man's greatest sin. This man's greatest sin is passivity. It is the do-nothing feature in masculinity. Now, ladies, for just a second, I'd invite you to check out of the room, because I want to have a conversation with us guys. This father's greatest sin is passivity, and fellas, quite frankly, we all got some of that. We've all got some of that. Passivity comes often when we confuse what is the intent of our heart. We try to just kind of cover it up and make sense of it. But our lives tend to be more fragmented. That's what males do. We are compartmentalized. We turn our focus to one thing at a time, and that's about what we intend to do. It's a good thing because it allows us the energy to pursue and find things to the finish. It's a good exercise, except for all the things in life that don't get our focus, but should. It's not a helpful quality when it comes to the items in life that we're not focused in on. And that feature of compartmentalization has a tendency to make us passive in places where we should be active. A father ought to be doing something about the jealousies forming among his children. A father ought to be careful about contributing to the jealousies that are already in place. An angry contention between the four women that he brought into his home, he did nothing. He did nothing about his own sin. He did nothing about the pain that that caused. He did nothing. Even when things began to go haywire, he didn't do a thing. This father, like many fathers, chooses the do-nothing route. It always looks like the easiest route to us men, until one day your kid's coat comes back to you stained with blood, and you're wondering what in the world happened. What went wrong? I mean, you can't say this to the grieving father, Jacob, but it's probably on your mind. You know, Jacob, it could have been something to do with how you raised him or how you didn't raise him. You don't say that to the father when you're standing in line at the funeral service. You can't say that. But you can see it here. Probably not so much what the father did. It's what he didn't do. No enemy is more subtle than passivity. And men, we all got some of that. It was the things in life he failed to stop. It was the things in life that he chose not to attend to. It was the things in life that he wasn't really sure how to handle, and so he chose simply not to handle them. He just let them go, and those things went wherever they willed. There's a second warning that comes from a dysfunctional home. They are the warning seeds of idleness. No enemy is more subtle than passivity. There's a third warning that comes in this text. It's the seeds of envy. No response is more cruel than jealousy. If you ever had to sit around a lawyer's table trying to settle who gets all the portions of dad's estate, maybe you've been right in the realm of what this means. No response is more cruel than jealousy. Instead of love and sharing, there's hatred and greed. Instead of submission and joyful giving, there are contests and hand over mouth whispers of manipulation. Instead of honoring the very one who gives the treasure of this departed father, there's contempt for your dad's wishes, scorn for everyone who seems to be grabbing at the same trinkets. No response is more cruel than jealousy. It's so hard in your home, isn't it? As parents, you try to love evenly. I'll bet you've even said that to one another as husband and wife. We're going to do our best to love evenly. We're going to love to be distributed in equal measure. But you know, in reality, as a parent, it's not about the equal distribution of attention. What it's truly about is the responsibility to meet each individual child's need. Go with me here for a second. That's the burden for parents. And quite frankly, some days one child needs more attention than another child, just for his shaping and his rearing. But try to explain that to the child who has lesser needs. It's a very interesting syndrome. I actually have a name for it. I call it the syndrome of the peanut butter bread. Let me describe it. It works like this. You have two hungry children that show up in your kitchen at the very same time. A slice of bread and a slip of peanut butter is going to satisfy their growling gizzards. You hand them both a slice of bread, peanut butter, ready to eat. They take it in their hands, and by some strange wind of happenstance, they both drop the bread at the same time, right in front of you. Now, for one of those kids, the bread drops peanut butter side up. For the other child, the bread drops peanut butter face to the floor. Those are two very different deals. But one of those, you kind of pick it up, dust it off a little bit, and you're pretty much good to go. But for the other, the face down bread is a whole nother deal. You've got this sticky mess on the floor. You peel it off the tile. You notice there's a garden full of specks and hair and things you don't even want to mention embedded in the peanut butter. You got to toss it out, clean it up, start all over again. It's a lot more work. Now, I guarantee you, in your home, you got one kid in your home for whom the bread always seems to land peanut butter side up. And you got one kid in your home for whom the bread always lands peanut butter side down. That was the case in our home. See, the key is how you react as a parent, how you react to the landing of the bread. It will tell the story of whether or not those immature children will have a relationship rooted in jealousy or a relationship that can be forged in love. It's the syndrome of the peanut butter bread. It's not so easy as a parent when all our kids are so different. The warning seeds of envy. No response is more cruel than jealousy. It's the third warning seed of dysfunction. Is it planted in your home? When Joseph was only 17, a lot of struggles of where he had come from showed up one day in a flurry. And in the weeks ahead, we'll get a chance to see what he made out of that mess. But for now, let's pay attention to the warnings. No enemy is exempt from adversity. Or no family, rather, is exempt from adversity. No enemy is more subtle than passivity. No response is more cruel than jealousy. Today is not about healing. There's absolutely no healing in chapter 37. It's only a picture of a family crisis that nobody in this room wants to repeat. But believe it or not, there is something more precious than healing. It is something called prevention. God speaks to us via prevention also. That's where his trustless guidance intervenes to set a course so we don't make those mistakes. It has to do with taking care of matters so that you don't get sick. Prevention has to do with lifestyle and long-term attitudes. It has to do with keeping up with what's going on now. It has to do with things like discipline and exercise and regular attention. Those are things you likely start to observe. But if they're not there, you see the warning signs. Listen to the warnings of Scripture. They are meant to help you steer clear of sorrow. The first detour in life for Joseph comes when he's 17 years old, and it is a doozy. Everybody he knows considers him dead. But this is a detour with God's greater destiny in mind. There's another chapter yet to be written. But will you allow God to write that chapter? We're actually going to conclude this service with an opportunity for us to pray about our families. We won't use a song to conclude, no. We just want there to be quiet. And in your own mind, you become a champion, a warrior of prayer for the people to whom God has assigned in your life. We want to practice being a warrior of prayer for our kids. So here's how we'll do it. We're just going to let silence rule the moments. You pray for your kids by name, see their face. You understand their situation. You also understand what's going on in your own marriage. What's happening over the threshold of your own kitchen? Those are the things you bring before the Lord. For the next several minutes, we're just going to pray for those precious people. Just give quiet, and when you have finished praying, just quietly get up, make your way to the doors. We'll have people at the doors kind of helping to get in and out so we can kind of keep the noise out there. But take the next few minutes, and you be a warrior of prayer in practice for the people that you love. Heavenly Father, would you hear the words of your people? Everybody in the room has some dysfunction that needs the divine intrusion that only you can give. Hear our prayers today. Through Jesus we pray.